Welcome once again to A Country First Conversation. We're continuing the Country First Conversations with Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler. During her time in Congress, Congresswoman Herrera Butler has been a champion for maternal health. Thanks for joining, and please visit countryfirst.com and choose country over party.
Well, hey, Jamie, how you doing? Look, it is, you know, we talk all the time, but it's good to have you on the billion subscribers Country First podcast. Thank you for doing it. You're my best friend in Congress, and even though we're far apart right now, which is why we're kind of having to do this over the phone, thanks for taking the time. How you been?
Oh, I'm doing great, and it's a pleasure to be on here with you. It is a little weird to do this over the phone because we've now worked together for 10 years, and I'm used to us, you know, talking in like the cloakroom or, you know, on the floor or something, or when we're doing stuff, but, you know, COVID. This is a pleasure to be here.
It's always COVID, you know, but, you know, look, I just want to tell people, so I met James, so we were both elected together, same time, and, you know, I still resent her a little bit because she beat me by 6 months in the youth category, and so she got all the attention as the youngest person in the class of 2010, and I'm like, hey, what about me, but 6 months difference. And I know she served in the state house.
But he hasn't held on to it.
No, not at all. Not 11 years later. I'm not still stewing over this, you know, like I am. But, you know, I want to tell people one of my very first impressions of you, because I think when we talk about what we're talking about, this is really important. So, you know, I was elected. I hadn't really served in any kind of a legislative capacity prior. I mean, I was on a county board, which is something, but, you know, it's not really the same. Mm-hmm. So Jamie comes in. I don't even remember what the meeting was. We have some meeting with somebody. And when you're new and you've never really been in politics before, my tendency was to just be like, you know, hey, be nice to everybody that comes in and talks and not press too hard. And I forget what the meeting was, but there was something where you're like, you asked the guy a question. He kind of gave you a little bit of an answer and you just drilled down. You just hammered to an answer from him and you finally got it. And I'm like, this is one of the toughest, like, people in Congress, and I never want to be on the receiving end of those questions. Do you remember that at all?
I mean, really vaguely, very, very vaguely. I used to be a lot more. I love to drill in. I love to get to the bottom of things. I have learned to pick and you got to pick and choose a little bit more. But in the beginning, there were so many things to work on. There's so much to fix. I'm kind of not surprised that was one of your first impressions of me.
I still like you, even though I just like, I got to stay on her good side. And because otherwise it's not going to be pretty. But let me ask you. So, you know, obviously, even being sick, so I thought I got into politics young, and you were in way before me, you know, state house prior, and then obviously 6 months younger, even getting elected to Congress. But what is it that what compelled you, what motivated you to run for Congress? And I guess kind of what keeps you motivated day to day, you know, in the tough time that we're in?
Mm-hmm. Well, something I don't know that a lot of people know about me is in my early years, I was raised in my district. My folks raised my brothers and I in Southwest Washington. Clark County is kind of the heart of my district. It's a fabulous area. And it's right on the Pacific coast. We have Mount St. Helens. The Columbia River separates us from Portland, Oregon, which I love. but when I was really young, up until high school, my mom homeschooled us, which back, you know, a million years ago, it was kind of countercultural. I mean, now there's so much more educational choice. But back then, it was really a new thing. And my folks had various reasons for doing it, but it meant that she really had to invent a lot of our curriculum. And for part of it, she started taking us to, I remember going to like March for Life rallies. I remember going to city council meetings. I remember having to write, I think we had to write a letter to the editor. I don't even know if we ever mailed it, but it was part of our writing assignment. And every year she'd take us up, and generally with a group of other, you know, there's other young people and other parents involved, but they take us up to Olympia, which is our state capital. And we'd get a tour and a lawmaker would come talk to us. And I was probably in fifth or sixth grade when I really felt like, a little touched. Like, I think this speaks to me. Like, there's something here that speaks to me. I think I'm going to be a part of this someday. And I also wish we also were really heavy on history, especially American history. I am a huge fan of American history, and that just sparked the passion for serving in public office. And, you know, as I got into college and high school and college, I started to volunteer. And over the course of a few different years, I ended up volunteering and interning. And, you know, Abraham Lincoln said, I will prepare and my time will come. And I remember very early on thinking, I got to prepare because I think this is part of my calling. I need to be ready. I didn't expect to get, so I got appointed and then elected to the state house when I was, I want to say 29. It was a special session and I was sworn in. And they drove me up to Olympia and I stepped out on the floor to take my first series of votes. And the next day, I think it was the next day, I turned 29. My birthday is November 3rd. This last year it was on election day. I don't know if that's fortuitous or not, but, I served there for 3 years and then this congressional seat kind of opened up, and through a series of different decisions, my husband and I decided we should do this. And when I got elected, I became the first Hispanic ever to represent Washington State federally, which is a huge honor. But it really, I think that this is the most amazing country on the face of the earth. We have a lot of problems, but in no other country could someone like me, who has no connection, right? My dad, is one of 10. He's Mexican. He grew up, he's American, but he's of Mexican descent, in California. And, you know, they were poor growing up, very poor. I mean, he's told me stories about not always having, you know, running water, or all of them crammed into like a one room house. And my folks, you know, moved up to our district when I was really little from California because they didn't want to raise us down there. They wanted to raise us in the Pacific Northwest. And they've worked hard and they did everything they could to provide a better life for my brothers and I. And only in this country would I, someone like me who really is, you know, no one special, get the opportunity to question, you know, presidents and CEOs and bureaucrats on behalf of my constituents. You know, I get to go toe to toe with these folks to make sure that they're serving, you know, my countrymen. That's amazing. And that only happens in this country.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. You know, as you told that, I realized, like, no matter how long we've been friends, like, there was some of that I didn't know about you. And it's actually pretty amazing how close our stories kind of align, because for me, you know, I was 6 years old living in Jacksonville, Florida at the time. And I remember leaving church at six. And, you know, there's a dude running for mayor named John Lewis. And I started asking my parents what these yard signs were, and they were hot pink. So, you know, it was the 80s. And, but it was like, that's what kind of started me on paying attention to politics. And, you know, that leads to things like, you know, how does government work? What is the newspaper? And then that grows. And and I've also always thought, now I don't, you know, my family's not really, you know, first generation immigrant, but, you know, my dad and mom, obviously fantastic people, but didn't have any connection to politics. My dad ran faith-based, you know, nonprofits. My mom, a public school teacher. And then this guy that, you know, was 6 months too late because you beat me, decides to run for Congress as a young person. I mean, 30 is young. And and we get elected to represent, you know, just shy of a million people. It's incredible when you think about, you know, despite all the bad kind of rap that Congress gets, and I think some of it's well-deserved, of course, recently, but it really is just a reflection of people, which is, I think, an important part to say, too, which is it also means that the people that elect people can have and should have authority over what that looks like in terms of, you know, who represents you, what your government is, and things along that line. It's pretty incredible. So when you look at the core of your service in – you know, the things that kind of compel you, you're very, you know, good on your principles. You don't waver from what you believe, but you also can reach across the aisle. You get things done where you can find common ground. What is it that motivates you to actually find solutions, to find common ground, to get things done instead of just engaging in the back and forth, you know, of the day?
I think You know, so just before this, I've had two Zoom meetings with different schools in my district. One was a middle school on a science project, a really cool project. One was a high school, and they wanted to talk about government. It was an honors class, and I got the same question in a different form. But basically, like, how do you work with people either whom you disagree with, or how do you, you know, what makes you want to? How do you get things done when obviously there are people who really oppose, you know, some of your ideas or your ideology? And honestly, you know, and I know this is something that I've had to learn over time, because when I first came in, of course, I was a little bit more. I laugh because I'm like, it's like a new marriage, right? You learn a lot. You make a lot of mistakes, right? You think you know everything, and you just need to tell people, and that's how you're going to get everything done. You just need to get everybody to listen to you. What I've learned is you have to build relationships, and you can build relationship with anyone. That's the remarkable thing. You can build relationship with people who think like you think and agree with you. You can also build a relationship with people who totally disagree with you on fundamental issues. One of the students asked me, so I started the Maternity Care Caucus in Congress. I started it with Lucille Roybal-Allard. She is a more liberal Democrat from the LA area. And I absolutely adore her. Now, the student asked, you know, how, you know, you're pro-life, you know, she's pro-choice. How in the world do you avoid conflict? And how did you start a caucus that's effective when you guys disagree on such a fundamental issue? And I said, well, that's the whole point, because we have relationship. There's some trust there. And we have been able to find common ground on things like getting, you know, corn masa enriched with folic acid to prevent birth defects in the Hispanic, you know, population, where corn masa is really a staple. We've been able to get, you know, legislation that helps, you know, fight the maternal mortality crisis. And we're working on, you know, legislation right now to further advance midwifery care, which we know makes a huge difference for moms and babies across this country. So we've actually been able to get, like, legislation signed into law. We've gotten, you know, bureaucracies to change their policies to benefit people. And yet we disagree on some big issues. And it all comes out of wanting to have some relationship, wanting to solve a problem or two. I thought everybody wanted that here. You and I know a lot of people do, but certainly not everybody.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, it's interesting you say that, because, like, that's the stuff that is super important, but you're not going to get a ton of, like, national media for starting, you know, the Maternity Caucus or dealing with those issues. But that's what has a real impact in people's lives, those kinds of things. And, you know, I think we've seen, you know, and it's a problem, frankly, everywhere in both parties, where people decide they want to be famous. And they, you know, they're going to play into the culture war of the day. And look, there's real cultural concerns, but, you know, what that drives media attention, and it drives donations, and it just divides. And let me, I want to stick to the maternal health thing, because you have a really unique story. For those who don't know, you were the 9th lawmaker in history to have a baby while serving in Congress. And not only is that really impressive, it is, you did it under severe circumstances. And I know the remarkable story about Abigail. I watched you go through this, but would you mind sharing with our listeners a little bit about her, what it was like when you got the news about her diagnosis and things like that?
Absolutely. Well, so I am the proud mother of 3 kiddos, Abigail, Ethan, and Isana. Abigail is about to turn 8. She'll turn 8 this summer, which is hard to believe. She's my oldest. Ethan's 5. Ethan just turned 5, and Isana just turned 2. And I've had them all while in Congress. Actually, Kathy McMillan Rogers and I, she's my fellow congresswoman from Eastern Washington, we are tied. This is not something I set out to do, by the way, for the most births while in office. Like, no one's ever had 3 kids while in office. And somebody was making a joke about that, because we both have 3 kids. And she looked at me and she goes, well, Jamie, it's your tie to break. And I was like, I'm good, thanks. But Abigail, when I it was our second term. I just won re-election, and I thought it was a great time to, you know, get pregnant and start our family. We had
Yeah, I like your decision making.
And I was about 5 months pregnant, and this is very typical. When you're about the fifth month or 20 weeks, you go and get what they call it an anomaly scan, where they check to make sure everything's, you know, you get an ultrasound, and they just, it's kind of a basic check. And during that scan, I will never forget this. We were here in DC, and I was at a hospital locally. And I just remember that the tech, like, his face went really white, like really ashen. And he just stopped kind of talking to us. Like, we were jabbering away because we thought we were going to figure out what the sex was that day. And we were all excited. And he started making phone calls, which is obviously weird. And then he just turned and he looked at me and he goes, "I need to send you across the street to go see a doctor. I don't see any kidneys." And I had, okay, I knew it was serious, but I had no idea what any of that meant. So we went over, we left the office and went over to the like main hospital, and the doctor was there waiting for us. And you know, a doctor's never waiting for you in a crowded doctor's office, right? And they ushered us into this back room and he said, "So your baby has, it's something called bilateral renal agenesis, or more commonly known as Potter syndrome. And it means that the baby never had kidneys, like they didn't form. So we don't see any kidneys, and it is 100% fatal." He said, "No baby has ever survived with this condition. They often either miscarry, because there's no, if you don't have kidneys, there's no fluid in your womb. And so everything gets scrunched. And so the baby often gets very deformed. But it just, they miscarry. And the worst outcome is, so no kidneys, like, you know, adults or even kids today have, you know, failed kidneys and they go on dialysis. But in utero, if there's no fluid, then the secondary, but a more lethal impact is that the lungs don't develop. So he said, even if your baby is miraculously born alive, your baby will suffocate pretty much within minutes because they won't, their lungs won't grow. And so they won't be able to exchange oxygen. And there's no way to fix that." And I got to tell you, there's nothing like getting that news. We had just made public that I was pregnant. You know, I waited 5 months to make the news public, because I don't know, that's everybody said you're supposed to wait until your second trimester. And then I get this news, Dan and I, my husband Dan, that this baby who was moving, this is the weird thing, is while he's telling me this, she's moving in mm-hmm. my stomach. Like, she's kicking, she's batting around, you know, she doesn't know there's a problem. And he's telling me with 100% certainty, she is going to die. And that was probably the worst 24 hours of my life. Me and Dan both. I can't describe it to you. You feel a bit like a tomb. It's just black. It's dark. You're coming face to face with death and your family. And it was doubly hard for me because she was moving around. Like, you know, you see a baby kicking, or you hear the story of a woman, "Oh, my baby's kicking. It's this joyous thing." But as she would kick, I would be reminded, "Oh my goodness, this baby's going to die." And in the awesome thing, I believe in Jesus as my savior. I think he has been, that is the most important relationship in my life. I talk to him daily, and it is one of the ways that I stay sane. And in that 24 hours, obviously my husband and I were like, "Why? What in the world are you doing to us? How in the world could this happen?" And it wasn't that I felt like God was punishing me, but I obviously, you know, it's a very difficult thing. And I just turned to him. And in that short time frame, boy, he just changed our perspective dramatically. We both felt like, okay, you're a parent now, for however long you get to be. And we really felt like he said, "You need to contend for her." Like, and when I say said, like, it's a sense, right? It's an internal conversation. I didn't like hear a voice from heaven. We got this kind of sense that you need to fight for this. And I didn't know what that meant. There were some scriptures that I found that, you know, there's all these different stories of where Jesus would heal people in the Bible. And I realized as I read the last part of the Bible, you know, the New Testament, where Jesus was walking around and doing his thing, every single person in scripture who came to Jesus and asked him for healing got healed. And so I was like, okay, well, I don't know anything about how this works, but I'm going to do everything I can to contend for her to be healed. And I didn't know what that was going to look like. Well, long story short, we obviously made public the, and I have the Facebook posted out there, just that we had received a fatal diagnosis from our doctors and that we were going to pray for a miracle. And the amount of like the outpouring that came from that was international. I had people calling my office and sending notes and emails. People would mail things. I mean, I was so honored. There was a tribe in my district who offered prayers beside one of the rivers. And, you know, they'd send me a gift. And people were trying to encourage me. I also got letters from people who had had babies with this condition who had died. You know, what was really crazy was it was during appropriation season, which is when the House is supposed to be passing all of the annual spending bills. And, you know, outside of COVID, it's when we're all on the floor. Like we're always there. We're voting. We're going through amendments. And so I'd have to go. I'd made this public. All of our colleagues knew this, Republicans and Democrats. And I'd go to the floor and you'd be on the floor for an hour or two voting on these amendments. And different members of Congress would come up to me. Republicans, Democrats, people I didn't even know well. I mean, I knew they were, I served with them, but I didn't have a relationship with them. And they would share with me their story. So many of them lost babies, lost adult children, had, you know, 5 miscarriages, couldn't get pregnant. It, just the stories and the humanity and just the desire, I think, to share my burden or help me bear it a little bit was unmatched. I just loved seeing the humanity out of our colleagues. It was also hard though, because I felt like my faith was building like this baby's going to live. And that's not to say that doctors who said otherwise were wrong, right? Their experience told them that that was all true. And I wasn't going to disrespect that, but I was kind of building my own faith. Like, I don't know what's going to happen, but I believe God's going to somehow give us this baby and it's going to be a path that maybe others can follow. And maybe this won't be a fatal condition anymore, right? So that's where my head was at. But then I have people coming and sharing how, you know, they lost an infant that they were fighting for. They lost a pregnancy, or they lost, again, an adult child. It was, I do need to write a book about it at some point, because it is an amazing story. We fast forward because it was made so public. This random person that I'd never met reached out and through a friend of a friend said, hey, I had a kid with a similar condition, not the same problem, but this, you know, a fatal diagnosis. And I found this doctor who was willing to try something different. Cause I started going to multiple doctors asking, hey, can you do this? Can you do this? Will you try this? And they all said, no, like, we don't treat this. We let this go. And I had doctors who were obviously recommending abortion. You know, one doctor said, I know you don't want to abort, but would you consider, you know, inducing early so you can at least see the baby before, you know, for a little bit before the baby dies, you know, this baby can miscarry. And I said, well, how early is early? And she said, like, now. Well, at that point, I think I was 22 weeks. So it would have been effectively the same as aborting. And she just said, I will never forget this. She said, you need to start over. Like, the sooner you start over, the easier this will be on you. And she meant it. She was trying to serve me, but I, at that point, was like, no way. I felt like I was supposed to contend for this baby. I'm her mom, and being her mom means I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to let this go because of me. You know, if she doesn't live, it's not going to be because I didn't try. And I found this doctor through this dad who in Johns Hopkins University was willing to put infusions in. So every week she'd put a saline injection into my womb to kind of mimic the amniotic fluid and give the lungs a chance to develop. And we didn't do that very long. Like, I remember getting up at, like, you know, 4 a.m. trying to get to Baltimore, to Johns Hopkins, before traffic, get an infusion, which is like, think of like a reverse amniocentesis, and then drive back to Washington, D.C. before traffic in order to get to committee on time, do my votes and, you know, do our work day. And I did that for like 5 weeks, I want to say. Sometimes I'd go up there a couple times a week. Yeah, it was intense. And then I went into labor early. So we were voting. It was a Friday. It was a flyout day where I was going to fly home to the West Coast. And the Democrats were calling, like, the Republicans had the majority. And so they were calling all these procedural votes. And so I'd have to leave committee. It was like 10 a.m. and run to the floor to vote, to not miss the vote. And I remember getting there on one occasion, and I just remember thinking, ugh, my stomach hurts. And like a dope, I didn't I mean, I'd never had a baby. I didn't know. I just thought it was my stomach was cramping, but it was actually contracting. So like, I was like starting labor. I didn't know. So then after both are done, I go to the airport to get on my flight back to Washington State. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, it sounds good. I'm going to get me some French fries and a milkshake, a chocolate milkshake. Typical food for a pregnant craving, right? And I remember stepping over the threshold of the airplane and I felt that same contraction again. I thought, huh, it was very fleeting. Like, I wonder if this is labor. And I was like, nah, I'm sure it was just a milkshake. Doesn't sit right. So I flew across the country and about halfway across, I was like, don't be an idiot. You're starting early labor, which of course, you know, at that point, I was just wanting to get home, and I did. That weekend, we fought off labor as long as we possibly could. It took like 4 days of in and out of the hospital trying to, you know, get my body to keep the bun in the oven. Because at that point, I was only at 28 weeks, which is very early.
Wow.
For a baby who has no medical problems, right? This baby was going to need dialysis immediately, which means it would require a surgery. And long story short, she came at 28 weeks. And I remember the morning, so we had been, they'd given me all these drugs to stop labor. So I was a mess. Like I was tired and I was out of it. It was like 4 days in these hospitals. I was transferred to several different hospitals. I think I felt like a hot potato. They were trying to get me to a higher level, like NICU. But then, you know, honestly, the hospital I ended up at originally had declined to really treat me. You know, some of the politics of the hospital were such that they didn't believe it was ethical. Now this isn't all of them. There were some amazing docs there who have been awesome. But some there really resisted my desire to try and fight for her life. They felt like I should have, terminated or just, you know, not done that. And it's interesting. So I remember the morning, it was like 3 or 4 a.m. And I was like, you know what? I looked at the nurse. I was like, she's going to come. There's nothing we can do to stop this. This is going to happen. We need to get ready. And so, you know, my husband went out to call people and all these doctors and nurses filled the room. It's amazing. My first pregnancy I was going to do with a midwife, like all natural. And now I'm in this situation where there's all these specialists in this room and everybody's staring at me. And honestly, it was very eerie because they all were expecting this to be a traumatic thing. Like this baby's going to die. And I'm a congresswoman. I'm sure they were also thinking this is also going to be a news event. And I'm sure they were hoping for me, but their clinical experience said this is going to end poorly. But I remember right before everybody came in, I was in the room by myself for like a second after I'd said, let's do this. And I could see my reflection in the, you know, the hospital TV. It was off, but I could see my face and I look terrible. I look like I've been in labor for 4 days. And I remember I just said, Jesus, save us. And I didn't feel any sense of peace. My emotions were just gone. I was exhausted, but I knew he was gonna. And so here we push, you know, she within like 3 pushes, here she popped out and somebody said, look down at your baby. She's tiny, itty bitty tiny. And her head was like a cone, poor thing. My husband later was like, did you see her head? And I was like, honey, that goes away. He was like so relieved. He didn't, nobody had told him that. Actually, right before she came, everybody's all quiet and tense, and he's holding my hand, and he goes, "Do you think we can get our money back for our prenatal class we never took?" And then everybody totally cracked up. But the thing that was amazing—that's so Dan, right? We didn't get our money back either. We never got the class. But the thing that was amazing is she opened her mouth and she cried, and you can't cry if your lungs don't work. And so I think everybody jumped a little bit of a start. And then the respiratory doctor picked her up and took off with her. And they didn't have to intubate her. She was breathing room air. She was basically treated like another, you know, very premature baby. Like she was beautiful. And I would argue perfect. And I knew God was going to, he was going to let me keep her. I think I knew for a little bit, before, you know, a month before that, I just had this sense, I'm going to get to keep this kid. I'm not going to have to bury her, which I really obviously didn't want to do. So she is, there's a whole lot more to her story, but she is about to finish first grade. Her and I just finished her horse diorama. She had her presentation today in class. She is healthy. She got a kidney transplant from my husband when she was about 2.5. So she's had her kidney now for 5 years. We call it her Kidneyversary. She hasn't been hospitalized in a few years, which is awesome. And she's sharp as a tack. She's a little too sharp. We used to call her Relentless, and I think she is relentless. This morning she was bugging me for my phone to play some apps, and I was like, you cannot have any apps. Like, no screen time.
I can attest to that. She is a little too sharp.
She's a little too sharp. She is a really smart. You know what's funny about her? So she loves American history, too. And she knows her history. Like, don't anybody question her on American history, because she will. My mom was asking her about presidents. She's like, Grandma, ask me about presidents. And my mom was like, who's the first president to, you know, ever leave office and get reelected, you know, with a break in their term? And of course she knew who it was. I was like, wait, that happened? I didn't even know that. So she told me one day she wanted to be the boss of mommy's work. Like, she was figuring it. This is the time Paul Ryan was the speaker. And I was like, and she figured out what the speaker was. And she's like, I want to do that. I think I could do that. And I was, well, honey.
She'd be a great speaker. I think we could put her in.
You know, she also told me, this is ironic, she could, there when the first Trump impeachment, she came with me to vote. I didn't have childcare. My husband and the other kids were back home in Washington State. It was like Christmas time. And so she came with me to the vote, the first vote, and then the second vote. Like, it was broken up into two votes. And I remember her and I were driving back in between the votes, and she was in the back seat in her car seat. And she goes, hey, Mom, is Donald Trump going to get impeached? And I said, yes. You know, but I don't know that he's going to be removed from office. You know, I don't think that's going to happen. And I was trying to explain the difference, and she got really quiet, and she was in the back seat, and she goes, I could do that job. And I was like, funny, out of the mouth of babes.
Listen, Jamie, you've got to write the book. You know, obviously I've known you for the whole time through that. And you know, probably half of what you told me I'd heard for the first time. And you're just you're an incredible person, and she's an incredible person. I think it's a testament to your faith, to your tenacity. And let me just ask you to kind of button this up, because I think this leads well into the question of fear. You know, you confronted fear. You confronted the unknown. I think politics, so you and I are both friends with Jamie Winship, and Jamie did one of these podcasts, encourage people to go back and listen if you haven't. But fear is what drives a lot of the negativity in politics. Just kind of buttoning this up, can you talk a little bit about how you confronted fear and how that kind of reminder plays into who you are as a person and a congressman today?
Well, I think I think Jamie has talked a lot about this, and I agree. Fear is probably the number one thing that we face. That's like our number one enemy. I was at the Smithsonian with this last weekend with my kids, and we were in the presidential exhibit, and it was Kennedy. You know, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And I stopped for a moment, and I just was pondering that. Like, that's what we have. That's what defeats us. It's not our shared challenges. Actually, as a nation, you know, the innovation that comes out of our creativity overcomes crazy challenges, like the challenge of Abigail's birth, right? Because of what I went through medically with her, other babies have now lived. That condition is no longer fatal. It's difficult, but it is not a fatal condition because of that. And as Americans, we come up with ingenuities all the time. The only thing that stops us dead in our tracks is fear. It paralyzes us, and it causes us to fight one another. And in Congress, the one thing I see now that I don't think was quite to this extent when you and I first started is fear. Everybody's afraid of everything, and it causes us to go into these corners and become so tribal and defend, you know, really what we're trying to do is protect ourselves, I guess. But we're really just making everything worse. And for me, confronting fear generally comes with using truth. You know, again, I believe in Jesus. I followed Jesus. I think one of the thing that sets him apart as a teacher and as a leader is, one of the things I should say is that his love, like the point of love is to disarm fear, to get rid of fear. And I think, you know, with love and truth, you can change the culture, even here in DC, even in politics. And that's been part of my goal That's why I love to work in bipartisan ways. I love to disarm. I love to come at something from a different perspective rather than always put your dukes up and fight. Sometimes the best way to handle a situation, I guess we probably all learned this in kindergarten, but is to use truth and love or respect or honor for someone and their humanity to disarm a situation. And I think you can get a lot more done. And my hope is, you know, my little contribution to that in Congress will be helping us turn this tide, because it's worth it. We need to do it for the good of the country.
Well, look, it's you know, you and I share the same faith, and you know, from a Jesus perspective, the thing I've come to realize is he's not super interested in our tax rates, but he is really interested in our hearts and in love for people. And you know, I think, you know, in fact, it was the Pharisees and his disciples that kept wanting him to, in essence, overthrow the state. Mm-hmm. And he just said, no, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's and unto God that which is God, and love your neighbor. And it's a lesson I think we can all take. I think churches can take it. People can take it. And we really appreciate you being on. And I want to say to everybody, too, you know, do a little stalking of Jamie if you don't know much about her on the internet. Learn about her story. And not real stalking, just, you know, internet. And
I get
her
it.
Website is, it's votejamie.com or .org?
.com, yep, votejamie.com.
Yeah, votejamie, but it's J-A-I-M-E. I always do it wrong. Vote J-A-I-M-E, Jaime, .com.
Got it.
And go and help her out. She's going to have a tough race, too. And but she is not, she is unrelenting. She's going to stand for truth. And that's what we need more of. So, Jamie, thanks for doing this. I appreciate you. And hopefully we'll see you not via the phone, but in person again soon. Say hey to your family.
We will. We will. Thank you, Adam. It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here.
You bet.
Take care.
This has been a Country First Conversation with Adam Kinzinger and our guest, Congresswoman Jamie Herrera-Butler. The Country First team wants to hear from you. Please be sure to share in the comments or send us a note at info@countryfirst.com to share your thoughts and feedback. And be sure to visit countryfirst.com for our other podcast conversations and subscribe to receive all the latest updates. Thank you again for joining us. This is Greg Ridenour, and we'll see you next time as we put country over party.